Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and we have lots of open seats up front, so while I'm doing this introduction, if anyone wants to come a little forward, we'd be happy to have you. Thanks again to Tim and the library. I want to highlight what a great partner the library's been, the space, the advertising. We do know that the videos from these events are watched 10 times more on the library site than they are at the city site. So I've had people come up to me in very random places saying, I saw you on a sustainability forum. So some people are out there watching. So tonight, again, thanks to the library. And special thanks to Jamie Kidwell, Sustainability Associate at the city, who has organized these, helped originate them, and makes them better and better every year. So thank you, Jamie. So tonight, we're going to talk about economic vitality. It's part of the city's sustainability framework. This is an effort that Jamie Kidwell was very involved in creating, taking a look at all the city goals and organizing them down around to about 16. And they're organized around four theme areas, adopted as policy, and they're part of our master plan. We also have a climate plan adopted by the city in 2012. And if you don't know, our goal is to reduce carbon emissions by 25% by 2025. I like this graphic. Our consultant created it while we created the climate plan. So the whole square is all the greenhouse gas emissions for the city of Ann Arbor, citywide. The little orange square is all the greenhouse gases from municipal service delivery. So cops, firefighters, picking up garbage, making water, treating wastewater. You can all guess what that big blue thing is and who's that. But the important part is the gray area, and that's the community, businesses, residents, what it takes to get up, get to work every day, and the other parts of the city. And that's the part that it's not clear how we go after that and bring energy efficiency and renewable energy into that world. So it's something that council put funds towards this year to fund some work on the community-facing side of our climate plan. And if you have questions about that after the event, I'm happy to talk about it. So the other important thing going on that's good for you to know is we've started in a climate partnership. And what is that group that's part of the businesses, residents, community foundations, nonprofit partners, Ecology Center, Watershed Council? That's been going on for about a year, looking at what are those things that we can engage the community around, like community solar and expanding organics collection in the city. So you'll be hearing more about that through the year. So tonight, these are our speakers. Wendy Ramson from the city of Ann Arbor, Amber Miller and Connie Pulsifer, Renee Bosch and Neil Harja from the Community Foundation. So often when you think about economic development, you think about how do we bring new businesses, biotech, app developers, those things to the city. But economic vitality is more than that. So tonight you're going to hear a series of small stories from our speakers. For example, how do you get your community ready for economic development? What's the role of private development in economic vitality? And also, what role does the physical form of the city play in attracting and keeping businesses? So that's where public investment comes in. We're also going to hear about government partnerships and new non-traditional businesses in the food sector. And then finally, what's the role of philanthropy in culture and arts in bringing economic vitality to the community? So each of these speakers will give you a little overview of what they're going to talk about, and after that, we'll raise the screen. Folks will come up to the table, and we'll have questions and answers. And if you would, come to the mic at the end for that. So with that, let me just remind you, the next two events, March 12th, we'll have a similar forum here at the library on sustainable systems, and April 9th, responsible resource use. So with that, I'll invite our first speaker, Wendy Ramson.
Matt?
So the economic vitality goal in the sustainability framework has a lot of nuance to it. In fact, of the 16 sustainability goals, it's the one with the most words. I'm looking at Jamie because she really tried to keep us down in the number of words. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read it for your benefit. We are to develop a prosperous, resilient local economy that provides opportunity by creating jobs, retaining and attracting talent, supporting a diversity of businesses across all sectors, and rewarding investment in our community. So the focus of my area, the Ann Arbor Planning Department and the Planning Commission, is on making sure that there are physical spaces to support the type of economic vitality that the community desires. So economic activity can happen in existing buildings, and Ann Arbor has a good base for that. We've got good bones, thanks in large part to the foresight of generations of investors in our built environment. But the built environment of the past doesn't always meet current needs, especially in commercial corridors such as Washtenaw Avenue or South State Street, if you can picture that area around Briarwood, which serve a very auto-focused customer base. The built environment may not be well-suited for future economic needs. So, for instance, businesses that will rely on transit or rely on fiber access, or businesses that are based on the sharing economy, like Airbnb. Also, there's a lot of space devoted to cars, particularly parking, that can be put to more productive use. This space can be used for new brick-and-mortar businesses and new tax base. So encouraging smart redevelopment, so that's the key, redevelopment of private property is a way to address some of these issues. This primarily takes the form of infill development. So for those who are unfamiliar with the term, that's where you have parking lots and vacant space, and you use that space to build new buildings. And redevelopment, which is actually oftentimes taking down buildings or building on to existing buildings. And this is primarily happening in commercial corridors and in the downtown. With that said, it's critical with this type of emphasis on building that we preserve Ann Arbor's unique sense of place, which is an important underpinning of all of our economic vitality. The built environment should enhance this as we adapt to our new economic realities. So it's important for the city to have tools and processes in place to guide this redevelopment in a way that provides new economic opportunities, such as jobs and tax base, and contributes to the city's unique character and sense of place. So that balance is super important. First, the community has to articulate its vision, for instance, through the sustainability framework that Matt mentioned and through our master plans. Then the community needs to align its regulations to implement that vision. And finally, set up a review and approval process for private development to get the community what it wants while allowing people who want to invest in Ann Arbor a deliberate, fair, and consistent development process to get there. So, with this in mind, the city applied for assistance from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation to be certified as a redevelopment-ready community, or RRC. In addition to sending a message to investors with this type of certification, it would also provide preference in grant applications, so we had another reason for trying to pursue this. So in 2013, the city of Ann Arbor was selected as one of eight communities to participate in the RRC program. And over the last year, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation has been looking at our processes and our performance on six best practices to see where we land in all of this. So I'd like to briefly highlight the best practices that MEDC says that we need to do to be a redevelopment-ready community, and then provide you with an example of each. So the first one, as I mentioned, is having community plans. So having a master plan that talks about where we want to be, a vision, a capital improvements plan to talk about how we implement the public infrastructure that supports that. Also, we need to have procedures and plans in place that help us identify stakeholders and how to engage them in this master planning and visioning process. So an example of this is several years ago, and I'm looking at Connie Pulsifer because she was one of the authors of this, The city created a citizen participation ordinance, and what that ordinance requires is developers of new projects must notify residents within a certain distance of the project in advance of coming into the city. The larger projects, a developer must actually hold a citizen participation meeting, and I think actually there's one going on upstairs tonight, and that is so that the developer can talk about what their ideas are for the site and answer questions. For some of the smaller projects, it just takes the form of a postcard so that the public has a heads up before they get an official public hearing notice. So that's one way that we can engage the public in this process, envisioning. Also, the next best practice is zoning regulations, which probably bore you to tears, but for those of us who work with this every day, zoning is a local ordinance that regulates land uses, massing, and placement of development on private property. It's really, really important when you're trying to talk about the shape of the city and what gets built. So the Redevelopment Ready Communities project looked at our zoning ordinance, and one of the things that we are trying to do to make it really clear to developers and also to neighbors about what is allowed and what is not allowed is to take all of our zoning and zoning-related ordinances and put them into a unified development manual. Now, this is some task because the zoning ordinance was written in 1963. Now, it's been updated since then, but it's been updated many, many times, and in fact, there's a lot of internal inconsistencies. So we're in the process right now of trying to bring those together so that we have a document that everyone understands. The next piece of this is that development review process, better known as site plan review. And so the best practice is that our site plan review policies should be clear, should be fair. There should be good communication between the city and a developer, between the city and neighborhoods, along with allowing for transparent processes so that you can find the information that you need about new development proposals. So one thing that the city does have is a software program called eTrackIt. I'm not sure why it's called that, but it's a piece of software that allows us to put all of the information related to that development proposal in one place. So you can go to a website and look up a project in your neighborhood, look at the plans in a PDF format, look at comments that are being provided by the departments, and then follow along with that process. That also allows for developers to have that access to comments from the various departments and be able to move forward in a timely way through the development process. The next best practice is for education and training of those people that look at development proposals at the city. These could be appointed officials like the Planning Commission, the Zoning Board of Appeals, the Design Review Board, or it also could mean the elected officials, City Council, that ultimately have decision-making authority. So the MEDC wanted us to look at how we do training, how we provide information for these citizens that are participating in these efforts to know what are the tools that need to be used, what are the legal limitations that they have. So we do, one example of this is when new council members are elected, the city administrator sets up orientation over 2 and 3 days where the new council members meet with city departments to talk about their functions and their activities. So that's an example that might be able to be carried throughout the organization. The MEDC is very much focused also on having communities identify redevelopment-ready sites. This wasn't a high priority for us so much because there is a lot of interest in private development in Ann Arbor, but in other cities where there is very little development interest, this is a way for a community to really put themselves forward and get some investment. But we do, in Ann Arbor, talk about sites that are owned by the city. In fact, one very close example is Library Lane, which contains the parking structure next door. And City Council has told the administrator that that he should go look for a broker and go market that property to try to get development that the community wants on that site. So that's an example of a redevelopment-ready site that we can consider. Finally, the best practice for community prosperity talks about or is interested in us really articulating what we want in the community. Do we want local businesses? Do we want high-tech businesses? Do we want all of that? Do we want to have the ability for people to work out of their homes, in which case we may need to change our zoning regulations to be more supportive of that? So this particular best practice, the MEDC also talked about the importance of a website, a community website, in providing that information. So the MEDC issued its report of our assessment in October and concluded that Ann Arbor was well on its way to becoming redevelopment ready and called out things such as the citizen participation ordinance and the downtown premium incentives as being particularly innovative. Their recommendations for changes include finishing our zoning project, shortening the site plan approval process, which will be an interesting discussion, packaging our key redevelopment sites, and creating an economic development and marketing strategy for the city itself, not for the region, but for the city. So the next steps are for City Council to take these into consideration and pass a resolution if they are supportive and have staff get to work at all of these initiatives. So I look forward to your questions later on, and I will pass it off to Connie and Amber.
So we're gonna co-use this podium here.
So we all know that downtown streets and sidewalks are busy, active places. And as you can see from the stats on the screen here, this activity is what we love about downtown. It's the special events, the sidewalk cafes, the walkability to and from work. And so all of these things are what make downtown great, but it also makes planning and constructing downtown streets a little bit of a challenge. And the demand for this space continues to grow. We want to make sure that we can meet that demand, continue to encourage these things, and support this activity in the great place downtown. So as this demand for the street and sidewalk space has been increasing, we saw the need for increased coordination, primarily between the DDA and the city, but also within the city itself. Multiple city units impact the street and sidewalk space, and also with private developers and other agencies. And we thought that by taking a very coordinated approach, we could do a better job of integrating the goals of these various agencies, whether it's economic or social or environmental. We also thought that we could do a better job with long-term planning. And we could make sure that maintenance was considered at the very start of a project. So when this manual is complete, there will be a technical document, really a toolbox of best practice standards to govern how the downtown streets are designed, built, and maintained. We see it as an implementation guide, something to help us take us from those large planning visions to actual construction of projects. It's organized by street type, so it recognizes that Main Street is different than Huron, and they need to be treated differently. It will be jointly owned and maintained by the DDA and the city. This has been a very collaborative process, and we plan on continuing that into the future. And we began with goals that we pulled from other city-approved plans in order to frame this manual. It was important that downtown streets be memorable, and they recognize the unique character of Ann Arbor, that they be safe and connected, that they support commerce downtown, that they meet our sustainability goals, and that they're streets that the community can be proud of.
So how to begin developing a downtown street design manual? We knew from the very beginning that in order to truly understand the downtown and all of its functions, We designed an engagement strategy that really ensured maximum involvement from the community. We knew we wanted to have an advisory committee on board made up of community members, people from Planning Commission, the university, and the DDA to help guide the process. We worked very closely with a technical committee of city staff, folks from the RIDE, folks from the DDA who are going to be using this design manual on a daily basis. So they were helping guide the process as well. And we also wanted to get into a lot deeper dive into the primary issues in the downtown. So we've had three rounds of focus groups with where we can address various types of issues in the downtown, from technical to environmental to construction and maintenance, and all the transportation components that make up this thriving community. We had some very active public engagement. Back last spring, you may have seen our design team pulling red wagons through downtown. We had maps and markers and stickers and dots that people could use, and we stopped at various popular locations in the downtown to get input. That way we engaged with over 200 people in on a sunny spring day, and we were lucky enough to get that process got written up in an Atlantic Cities article, so that was kind of fun to see that they recognized sort of that innovative technique of taking the show on the road to talk to the community and meet the community where they like to be. We plan to have a public open house this spring, our second open house, and on the back counter you'll see that there is a sign-in sheet. If you'd like to leave your email address, we will notify you when that open house comes up or other notifications about the project. So the Downtown Street Design Manual used a process called street typology approach. And really what that does is it seeks to balance the needs of all street users in the downtown, recognizing there's a lot of different uses and a lot of different functions in the downtown, and really connecting those and combining those and creating flexible guidelines and standards for each downtown street type that will work both from a functional emphasis and by fully understanding the character of downtown district traits and the atmosphere that each different district has. Most importantly, we're really focusing on place. It's very important that we understand each district completely rather than looking just at this project as the right-of-way that goes from building face to building face as a piece of infrastructure. We're looking at it more from the building in. So understanding the character and the context of downtown before we make decisions about what happens in those right-of-way places. By looking at these typologies through very vigorous community engagement, really understanding other downtown plans that we've developed, and by thoroughly evaluating frontage context and functional emphasis in the downtown, we've created a framework plan that you see in front of you that we really think is going to help serve as a very solid decision-making guide as we make improvements over the next several years and decades. This is going to be a plan that's going to continue to evolve. The colors on the map, they map out envisioned context in the downtown, such as, is this a commercial area? Is this a near neighborhood area? Does this area have kind of a mixture of uses, including residential and office and commercial? So we sought to understand the context first. The lines, the dots and the dashes, the black lines, dots, and dashes on the plan designate various functions whether a street is primarily a business street or is there primarily a transit emphasis in that area. Is this an important truck route and vehicular route for crosstown traffic, or is there a bicycle emphasis on this street? So we map that out as well. So while all the streets need to be designed for all users in the true complete streets model. When we're making improvements, this map is going to help guide us towards what types of improvements to emphasize that will enhance the context and benefit the primary function of any given street. So here's kind of a section and an example of how we look at streets when we look at the entire right-of-way from building face in. It really is made up of many different types of zones which have very different users and activities. So up closest to the buildings, of course, we have our pedestrian zones, which are also broken down into subzones of their own, like frontage, up against the building, the sidewalk zone where the people pass along the sidewalks, the amenity zone where we have things like trees and bike hoops and benches and trash receptacles. And then within the street zone itself, we have a curbside zone that could either have parked cars or bike lanes or perhaps bike corrals. And then the roadway zone is also made up of various lanes of traffic and with special characteristics at intersections. So within these street zones, what we're envisioning is that treatments need to be designed to support whatever designation it is. For example, a pedestrian zone we know needs to accommodate wide sidewalks so we can handle the influx of evening and weekend traffic in our pedestrian traffic in our downtown. We need street trees for shade and seat walls and benches for people to feel comfortable, lighting, bike racks, all those things and elements that attract people to our downtown and make them feel comfortable. Commercial support areas need to pay particular attention to clear parking and loading zones. Excuse me. Waste pickup areas, special event accommodations, and cafe seating. All those elements that make businesses economically viable. And I'm going to get myself some water. We know also that some streets are better suited for on-street bicycle travel than others. So we've designated certain streets where bikes, we want to have special accommodations for bikes. Even though bikes are allowed on all streets, we know that there's some streets that have higher levels of biking, especially riding cross town to campus. So what we want to consider when improvements are made to these streets, we're going to be testing some forward-thinking ideas, such as buffered bike lanes on certain streets or bike boxes at intersections or bike corrals and other accommodations that increase the comfort level for cyclists with all levels of risk tolerance. So the idea is that make some of these streets feel more comfortable to cyclists so they won't be as inclined to want to ride on the sidewalks. We're also looking at potential improvements for some of the major transit corridors in the downtown or routes in the downtown. The ride and its users can really benefit from some treatments that make loading and unloading more efficient and customer-friendly, like the example up in the upper left-hand corner. It's a bulb out which allows buses to pull right up to people loading and getting off the buses and makes much more comfortable loading environment for the passenger and allows the bus to continue on its way rather than having to pull out into traffic. And we'll be looking at other forward-thinking ideas like bus-only lanes and perhaps signal timing to allow buses to jump out in front of traffic and so they can keep on schedule and improve ridership in the downtown. We also heard from the community that we need to pay close attention to the unique characteristics of the different districts. And above all else, we need to keep Ann Arbor funky. We heard that over and over again. We love the funkiness of our downtown. So this isn't intended to create a mall-like atmosphere, but to build on the characteristics that we love so well. So we're planning for various design elements that are distinctly Carytown, for example, with brick streets and historic buildings. And we understand that those neighborhoods are different than the look and feel of a State Street or a Liberty or a Main Street. So we take that into consideration. Well, good thing it's your turn, so I'm losing my voice.
So we're going to wrap up quickly because Jamie's giving us the signal back there. So as we wrap up, we wanted to give you a local example of what happens when you think about place and context first when you redesign streets. And I'm sure many of you remember 5th and Division streets before they were improved. Here are some images prior to the improvements. You can see the lanes are very wide, sidewalks are narrow. It's really not a terribly pleasant place to walk or to be. And then after the improvements, we were able to make room for multiple users, adding bus stops and bike lanes, taxi stands, adding bulb outs at the corner so that it was easier to cross the street, adding street lights, trees, and on-street parking so as a pedestrian you felt safer and buffered from the car traffic. We were also able to add space for commerce, space for sidewalk seating. And for those of you who can't read this quote, I'll read it very briefly. The addition of the newly designed DDA streetscape has brought energy to Midtown and our restaurant. The vitality of our space begins on the street before you even enter our doors. That was a quote from Adam Baru of Mani Osteria. And it is this vitality, this level of activity that we're hoping to achieve through this downtown street design manual.
Thank you. And before I bring on our next speaker, I want to acknowledge, because she's an elected official, I want to acknowledge we have a couple of elected officials here. Councilmember Westfall, Councilmember Eaton. Is there anybody else I've missed? I just want to make sure folks know they're in the room. So next, we're going to hear from Rena Bosch, who is Ann Arbor Township's city clerk, right?
Township clerk.
Excuse me. But also a local business owner and part of our local food security economic partnership. So welcome, Rena.
I'm going to talk a little bit about how local food systems relate to economic vitality. And as Matt mentioned, I have three different perspectives on this as a local food business owner, as working in the nonprofit world on a board that was trying to do agricultural economic development, and also an Ann Arbor Charter Township. We've been very proactive in land preservation and farmland preservation, as has the city of Ann Arbor. So something that I was thinking about, you know, before you can have economic vitality in a region, you actually need to already have a robust food system. If you think about it, if too large a percentage of the population is hungry or engaged in feeding their family with most of their time, they can't actually contribute to the economy. But once you have those resources in place and you have a robust food system, then the food system itself continues to feed not only people, but also the local economy. And so that's what I'm hoping to talk a little bit about today. So what is a food system? Like any other system, it's a series of components that form a very complex whole. This is a really simple series of those components: production, processing, distribution, consumption, are all of our favorites, and the waste management. So in production, there's a lot of things that fall under that. That's agricultural production of vegetables, animals. There's managing orchards and perennials and other tree crops. Under the processing area, there are all different kinds of things, you know, from the washing and packing to actual canning and processing, freezing, butchering, making cheese, baking, anything that takes raw ingredients and turns them into something that you can eat. That's all part of processing. And the distribution, that's not just getting the food around, but also getting the food to the people through the restaurants. We just heard about one of our favorites, and the grocery stores, as well as storage and consumption. We all eat. We're all a big part of this system. And then managing the waste at all these different steps is also a big part of a food system. And so in case you can't read in the back, At the center, I have a sustainable food system integrates elements to enhance environmental, economic, social, and nutritional health for all. I would also add that there are a couple of pieces missing. A local food system also needs to be robust and resilient, and part of that would also mean that it should be diverse. So the other thing that people always ask about was, what does local mean? And so I just thought I would real quickly mention that, yes, food systems have a variety of scales, and we're probably more robust if we have a diversity in scale. Probably never thought about it, but some of these larger systems are perhaps more fragile than you would imagine, like on a global scale. If there's, say, drought in California, well, then we no longer have, you know, a very regular source. So we're actually more robust if we have food systems operating at all these different levels. But tonight we're going to mostly focus on the regional and actually the hyper-local food system that's in our area. Something else that I wanted to mention is that even at a national and at a state level, there's kind of an agreement that there are several issues in the current state of our food system in the U.S. And I've listed these issues here. And we're really fortunate in our community that we are addressing these things. Michigan, in particular, has a diversity of agricultural production and foods production. Something that's happening across the country is the aging of the farmer population. I think the number, it's the average age of a farmer is something around 65 now. Access to land is a challenge for new farmers throughout the country, as well as access to training and support. And there's been, with the consolidation that happens with large-scale systems, a lack of local processing and distribution, but not in our area. We are really fortunate to be working on all these issues. Now, as I mentioned, in our area, we have so much going on that it's actually kind of hard to focus on a couple of things. But what I've chosen to do is to pick three projects. Really, in this entire system, we have what I would call hyper-local examples of things going on in the production, the waste, the consumption, the distribution, the processing, and all those areas. But tonight, I just wanted to call your attention to three projects that are in our area. The first one is the Ann Arbor Greenbelt. The second one is the Tillian Farm Development Center. And the third one is the Washtenaw Food Hub. Now, when I say hyper-local food system, I really mean hyper-local food system. Here is the map of those three projects. The green line delineates the Ann Arbor Greenbelt area. And then you can see the two red stars indicating the Washtenaw Food Hub on Warren Road. On Whitmore Lake Road, right at Warren Road. That's about maybe 4 miles from the Ann Arbor Farmers Market. Janine would probably know better than I. And the Tillian Farm Development Center is right there on Pontiac Trail. Both of these things just happen to be located in Ann Arbor Charter Township. So the first one, the Ann Arbor Greenbelt, I'm sure you guys, most of you recognize some of these folks like Ginny Trocchio. The Ann Arbor Greenbelt really enables our local agricultural production. There's an open space and park preservation millage that the city residents passed. Right, they agreed to tax themselves for 30 years, as did the Ann Arbor Township residents, to provide for purchase of open space and park preservation. But what many people might not realize is that a portion of that money is also used to preserve farmland via development rights purchase, or purchase of development rights is the way it's usually said, or PDR. And through using the purchase of development rights, the Ann Arbor Greenbelt has preserved 38 working farms. And I'm not sure, are people familiar with what purchase of development rights means? No. Give me some more heads, so I'll know. Okay. So basically what that means is that we're using taxpayer money to purchase a conservation easement. So the land stays in private hands, The private landowner receives a chunk of money in order to put a restriction on the deed that runs forevermore, that this land will not be developed. It will be, for example, perpetually in agriculture. So, for example, if agricultural land is selling for $5,000 an acre, and that same land, if it was going to be sold to a developer for a suburb, might be sold for $15,000 an acre, that difference, that $10,000 an acre, that's what we basically think of as the price of the development rights, the right to develop your land. And so we have chosen in our community to use public money to give that landowner this money so that they will therefore keep the land in agricultural production. It's a really unique program, and it's working really well in this area. And it's still private land, right? And so now it has been, now there's no longer this pressure to develop it, and so it enables young farmers who might not have as much capital on hand to purchase land. And so these were the stats that I got from Ginny, and they've probably increased, but we have 38 working farms preserved and 4 new farmers purchased land. So the Greenbelt has really been a success. Another program that I wanted to tell you about is called the Tillian Farm Development Center, and this really enables new farm businesses. This is a farm business incubator and training program. Just like other business incubators operated in our area, we are really fortunate to have this one. It came from, a very unique public nonprofit partnership. The vision came together. Actually, it really actually came together in 2008. I imagine people were envisioning it earlier than that. What happened was that in Ann Arbor Township, we did a development deal that allowed clustering of homes in a corner of a large in two corners of a large parcel in exchange for preserving 153 acres in the center of the parcel that was prime agricultural land. And so the developer got to put a few more houses than they would have otherwise with traditional zoning, and then we preserved this land perpetually for agriculture. And the developer then deeded the land to the township. About the same time, the Ann Arbor Township Farmland and Open Space Preservation Board envisioned getting involved in a small farms initiative. And then, coincidentally, a nonprofit and the Food System Economic Partnership, as well as Nifty Hoops, they all came together with the township to form this incubator and got some grants and got it started. So in 2011, 3 farm businesses started a 2-year program at the farm. And this coming season, we have more than 9 businesses located there. So it's pretty exciting. The other project that's happening is called the Washtenaw Food Hub. And this is a property, again, in Ann Arbor Township. It's a 16-acre agricultural parcel, which is awfully small for real agriculture, but it happens to have something like 10 or 11 barns on the property and other ag. So it's got a tremendous amount of infrastructure. The owners of Tantre Organic Farm out in Chelsea, Deb and Richard, had the vision to purchase this property, and I put their mission up there. They really see this as a community hub as well as a local food systems economic hub. I'm getting the 0 minutes, so I'm going to keep going really fast. The Washtenaw Food Hub enables local food processing, another big part of our food system. You can see that it started off as a bunch of empty barns, and now they've been redone. They got solar panels on the roof. This empty room then became this, and now it's the home of the brinery. So speaking of the brinery, I thought I would give a couple of quick examples of how our hyper-local food system is really working. These cabbages were grown at Tillian by a new young farmer. They're harvested and lined up in the hallway at the Washtenaw Food Hub. There's the brinery. That's David, the owner of the brinery, holding a watermelon radish. And the gang is making kraut, which then is fermented at the food hub and distributed locally and available like at many of our local food outlets. And my business as well, does this. We've purchased a lot of food. I could only find pictures of squash and cauliflower, but we've purchased and tomatoes and snap peas and pumpkins and other things from Tillion. They've been processed for freezing at the Washtenaw Food Hub and then packaged and, again, distributed locally through outlets such as the Argus Farm Stop and the People's Food Co-op. So we really have this whole circle of the local food system operating locally in our community.
Thank you, Rena. And I love learning something new at all of these. So, and it's, I know it's tight, but it gives time for questions at the end. So I'll get out of your way. I want to introduce Neil Hajra, who's the new president and CEO of the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation, and he's going to talk about some of the vision that they have for philanthropy in the community and how that's going to spur our economic vitality. Neil.
Thanks. Hey, I remember – oh, hey, Deb. How you doing? I remember coming here when I was a kid – and I'd immediately go to the card catalog and maybe the Encyclopedia Britannica. So how times have changed, right? And yet here we are at the district library, and it's still just a buzzing hub for the community. So hats off to the library. It's always been an institution I've admired because it just keeps changing with the times, right, which is pretty sweet. So I've got my clicker, and let me, before I launch into what I really want to talk about, let me tell you about the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation for a moment. We're a 52-year-old organization, and if I really wrapped it up in a nutshell, I'd say you can think of us in this way. We are a foundation that's dedicated to a geography. That geography is Washtenaw County and Plymouth, and it's expanded over the years. It started off as sort of Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, and has slowly grown out since then. The other distinguishing factor for us is we're all about permanent community capital. Some people call us a savings account for the community. There are 700 community foundations around the country. The story I like to tell that illustrates this really well is what we try to do is we raise money, and we work with hundreds of volunteers to do this. We invest the money permanently, and then we grant out some of the proceeds every year to nonprofits with the idea of doing that on a permanent basis. So the Oscar Reimold Fund was founded in 1980 with about $500,000. Since that time, it's grown to $1.4 million, so it's kept up with inflation, but it's also granted out approximately that much since 1980. So that's the power of the model. Given time, imagine just a big snowball of awesomeness, right? And we just keep pushing it down the hill. That's what we're all about. And the other observation I'll make about our community foundation, so we're approaching $80 million in assets. We've given out a lot of money as well. The one thing that's really clear in our work is we are not nearly large enough to make significant community change. So I love hearing from everyone here about their roles in economic vitality because we play one very small part. And if there's one thing that I'm convinced of is we have to be really networked even more closely as a community to keep pushing the needle on community change. So what I want to talk about is I keep regretting that we gave it such a long label, but we call it cultural economic development. And it's very simply the premise that the arts and culture sector in Washtenaw County, and obviously with a lot of it centered in the Ann Arbor area, plays a very important role in the economic vitality of our community. And just a bit of background first. So we've been involved in funding the arts for decades. Like I mentioned, we're a half-century-old organization. A couple years ago, we started asking a lot of questions, both about what's going on in the arts and culture sector, as well as what role could the Community Foundation play in promoting economic vitality. This was in addition to our tireless work around human services. We're very proud of all the investments we continue to make on the social safety net, and we consider ourselves a champion of that. But we knew that as a community foundation, we needed to take the broader picture, so we were sort of examining the background of what was going on. Based on conversations with 50 or more community leaders and arts institutions, a couple of things came to mind. One was we are, as a community, very proud of the UMSs of the world and the Michigan theaters and the summer festivals and the art centers. We all know and love these institutions. But we're not as aware of just how much blood, sweat, and tears goes into making those institutions successful, especially after 2008 and sort of the fluctuations of the big three. We were very dependent on corporate support in the arts and culture sector, and that landscape has changed. Arts institutions have done a great job of adapting with that change, but the fact of the matter is we need to bring more attention to the need for the community to rally around arts and culture and continue to support it. So what we realized is there was sort of a confluence of two things. One was we saw an opportunity for us to play a greater role in the health of the arts and culture sector, but we wanted to link that work to economic vitality. And we wanted to do so with more than just anecdote. We wanted to actually start showing the measurable impact of our work and the work of others on the community through arts and culture. And that's what led to cultural economic development. And for those of you who can't read it, it's a pretty simple premise. Cultural economic development will spur community prosperity by advancing our local arts and cultural resources. So pretty straightforward, right? And we actually selected three distinct strategies in which to pursue this. And just so you know, as a community foundation, we have the luxury of taking the long view. So we consider this a decade-long initiative that we're committed to. And think about that snowball. This is yet another snowball we want to start rolling down the hill and see it get bigger and bigger year after year. So the three strategies that we see ourselves in are applying knowledge, building strength, and leading community. And the phase we're in, because it's a young initiative, is the first phase is really the applying knowledge strategy. So I put some words up there on measuring return on arts investment, which is important. In a nutshell, what we want to do is we want to be able to articulate specifically and numerically the economic impact that the local arts and culture sector has in Washtenaw County. We know it anecdotally, right? And we hear this all the time, but we actually want to put numbers to that. We want to be careful, though, because we don't want to just express the value of the arts through its economic impact. That's one of many values, and Deb and I have talked about this. There's arts for education. There's arts for the sake of art. There's arts as community vibrancy. There's young professional retention in the arts. There's placemaking. There's many, many different values to arts and culture. What we're simply saying is this is a misunderstood area and value of arts and culture that we think would compel more people to support arts and culture if they understood the impact. And so what we're currently doing right now is we're in the midst, along with the Arts Alliance and Deb, of a year-long study that's based on a national model promulgated by the Americans for the Arts. This study actually surveys arts patrons and consumers, and we'll probably do more than 1,000 by the time it's all said and done, as well as arts institutions and specifically nonprofit institutions, and I'm sure we'll probably survey over 50 organizations. When we're done, this model will tell us several things. It's kind of an input-output model. What it'll tell us is for every amount of money invested in an arts and culture organization in Washtenaw County, we'll be able to, based on the data, tell you four things. How much ripple effect spending is triggered by an investment in the arts and culture organization? How many jobs are generated by the arts and culture organization? So, for example, University Musical Society employs people and pays caterers to do events and employs many. The ripple effect spending, if there's an event going on in the Art Center, maybe I've paid for babysitting, I've paid for parking, maybe I buy a coffee before, maybe I go out to dinner afterwards. The other two aspects that this model measures are local tax generation in support of the community, as well as state tax generation. And so this is real data based on Washtenaw County, and we'll conclude some preliminary results by April, and we'll announce that at our annual meeting on April 30th. We'll continue the work and finalize the data and the results by the end of the summer, I think. And this is the foundation for much of our work. Once we have this model in place, we're going to seek out partners and others to invest with along with our money in exciting arts and culture initiatives that have a demonstrable economic impact. We also want to grow the ones that are already having an impact, and with this tool, we'll hopefully be able to convince others to do the same. That gets us to our second piece, which we call leading community. What we want to do is team up with others to invest in exciting catalytic arts and culture events. So our first investment was this past year, actually in a venerable 105-year-old institution, the Ann Arbor Art Center. You may not think a century-old institution is full of innovation, but they sure are. And they're going to be putting on a new visual arts festival starting in October of 2015 that they're calling Pop X. They're going to start in Liberty Plaza, with 10 sort of pop-up visual arts installations. In addition to the art, there's going to be activities and lecturing and learnings and education and convenings around those things. And so think about it from our perspective. We've invested in an exciting, new, vibrant artistic endeavor, and yet we're also paying attention to pulling people downtown, exciting people about arts and culture. Maybe folks from out of the county are coming in and spending their money too, and these are all good things in addition to all the other reasons we love the arts so much. And so we've made our first investment. We're looking to make another investment this year, and we are seeking ideas for catalytic new investments. My one observation about that, and this is a lesson learned by us, is we have no shortage of ideas in this community, which is fantastic, but we try to link those ideas to a champion. If we can't find a champion to further what that idea is, we won't invest in it because we're a foundation. Our specialty is managing community capital and granting out to nonprofits. Our specialty is not creating the next great festival. That's not what we're built to do, so we need partners to do that. So I'd encourage all of you to contact me and our staff if you've heard of or want to talk about potentially great catalytic ideas in the arts and culture space. And finally, the last prong of our strategy we called building strength, and it simply, I would boil it down as saying we know the capacity in Washtenaw County for arts and culture support is very great, and we want our efforts to bring attention to arts and culture to increase funding for arts and culture locally. It's incredibly important to us. We want to build funds for arts and culture. We want to see arts and culture institutions get more money from donors. And we actually want to transform our own grant making, grow it, and make it more effective as well to support arts and culture. And so with that, I'll simply say stay tuned. We're really excited to release the results of our study. We're always looking for partners in this work, and we're looking forward to hearing back from a lot of you on it. Thank you.
So with that, I would again thank our speakers, and we'll take the first questions.
I have a couple questions. One is, on the drawing, I saw some cutaways for bus stops, and I'm really concerned with the practice in Ann Arbor right now where we have buses stopping, loading, unloading, and when they get to their stop early, they just wait until it's time to leave again. And they're doing that within 20 feet of crosswalks, especially on 4th northbound near Liberty, and that's blocking visibility to pedestrians. And could anyone comment on that, if I'm mistaken, or if that cutout is really that close, and why do we have it there?
Kathy, are you talking about the bus loading so on 4th, and you're wondering why the buses are so close to the intersection idling?
Yes. Well, and in your drawing, one of the drawings that you showed, the buses, they look like they pulled almost up to that little bump out where the crosswalk
okay.
was.
I see what you're talking about.
As well.
Well, that was just a visual we put in there. It wasn't place specific. It was an idea that other communities have used. It's called bus bulb outs, and it basically extends the curb out. It's sort of like a bump out at an intersection, but it would be more mid-block, so that when a bus stops for passengers, passengers aren't having to walk through parked cars, and the buses aren't having to maneuver over to the curb. They can stay in the travel lane and load onto the bus from this bump out area.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, I like the concept. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't within 20 feet of the crosswalk.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Very good point. And just an overall comment about the downtown design manual is, you know, these are concepts and ideas that would need to be tested on every project. So we'd look at things like that, you know, how close is it to an intersection, and what street does it work on? So these aren't necessarily place-specific suggestions as ideas that we need to have in our toolbox to think about when we look at improvements on the streets.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Next question.
Great. Hi, my name is Audrey. I have a question for Neil. I'm sorry, that's your name, right?
Yeah.
Neil?
You got it.
Great.
Audrey.
so I had a question on how you would track the ripple effect that you were mentioning, the demonstrable economic effect. And I really like that you touched on how each of our well-being really depends on the social construct of things. But back to my question, I was just wondering how you would be tracking the economic ripple. And when you're presenting that data, how would you present it?
Sure, that's a great question. So first of all, the methodology we're using in the survey tools were developed nationally. And I should mention, the model itself was developed by an economist based out of Georgia Tech, and I actually don't recall his name. So in the design of the surveys that we and the Arts Alliance are administering, there are the questions to arts patrons and consumers actually, and I wish I had it in front of me, have a list of different examples of the kinds of things someone may do while they're going to an event or leaving an event. So there are literally questions about how much did you spend on parking? Did you buy food today? What else did you spend money on? And so in each survey, we're effectively capturing the ripple effect for that individual, and then through the national model, we're creating a statistically significant representation of that, saying, okay, across 1,000 surveys, here's the typical ripple effect spending of a consumer. Now, will it vary from event to event? You betcha, and whether it's winter or summer might matter and that sort of thing. So there's always some estimation going on, but we're using nothing but Washtenaw County data to basically measure what's the typical Washtenaw County visitor spending in addition to the actual event itself. So that's what we'll use. And, right. And Deb, do you want to add to that?
I think the other thing, and you touched on this earlier, Neil, that the AFTA, Americans for the Arts model, also very much uses data from the nonprofit arts organizations that they collect on their spending and their ripple, too. So, again, like an organization like the Arts Alliance, we pay printers, and all that ripple that has to do with job and development. So it's a pretty thorough survey, and as has been said, the model's been tried, tested, and actually they started using it, I think we're probably into 15 years. And Ann Arbor had been part of one of these studies back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. So it'll also be interesting to see how that's shifted and changed over time.
Okay, so I guess, is the presentation of this data going to be coming out in March of 2016, or was this data collected last year with the hope that you would be like calculating and presenting all this data?
Sure. So we actually started collecting data last summer. We're going to continue to collect data through the summer of 15, only because we want to make sure we're touching on a lot of different activities throughout the county and not just Ann Arbor. So here's the arrangement we have with our national partners, the Americans for the Arts. They're going to compile preliminary data for us for April, so that at our April 30th annual meeting at the Sheraton, we can announce the preliminary overall results in terms of what this model looks like. Then we're going to keep adding to the data through the spring and summer, so we'll have a finalized, basically, model by the end of the summer. Which may not vary much from the one we present in April, but there will be new data added to that as well. So actually, by the end of the summer of 2015 this year, we're going to have the information compiled, and then the next step, frankly, is to look to all of you to help us get the word out to many, many different institutions and organizations. We think this can be really powerful for a lot of different groups.
Great. Thank you so much for clarifying.
Sure.
Hello. Robert, I was reading in the Ann, who cares about the creative class, and it had a really interesting, to me, the two most cited options for improving life for creatives in Ann Arbor, increasing the number of mixed-use spaces and zoning for additional dwelling units. Can you advise if any panel members could advise if there's some movement toward that? That's one question. And then two is, do you have any ideas to preserve the creative class? While arts is nice, there's also, there's musicians, there's artists, there's entertainers, or I don't know, there's the whole spectrum of that.
Okay, Wendy, do you want to start?
Well, I'll start it up. I will start off in terms of Yes, there is an interest in providing for more opportunities for people to live in Ann Arbor. Typically, I think people think about downtown and some of the initiatives that the Planning Commission and City Council have been working on, the Ann Arbor Discovering Downtown, which seeks to encourage new mixed-use development, residential development in the downtown. But that's a piece of it. The other piece that's probably maybe a little bit more exciting is what we're trying to do on Washtenaw, the Reimagine Washtenaw effort. And that is to try to, as developers rethink these old commercial spaces, to think about adding residential to them, either on top of the commercial space or proximate, you know, nearby, behind, so that we can start creating these corridors that happen. You know, there's more stuff going on. There's transit access where they can get to and from places. And it's actually, quite frankly, more affordable than what you might try to accomplish in the downtown, because land values are so high in the downtown. It's really hard to try to create those units that people can afford. So that's kind of what's happening right now within the planning and zoning area. Neil, you want to?
I'll just add a comment on the creative class. So a lot of work shows that it's those vibrant communities with rich arts and culture, strong environment, a combination of factors that keeps folks in a community. When we talk to businesses, they talk a lot about wanting to build more of a vibrant community to retain young talent. That's a sort of a theme that I hear a lot when I'm speaking with medium and large business owners based downtown. We have to be careful, and we talk about this a lot at the Community Foundation, is we don't just want to cater to the creative class, if you will. We're trying to take an approach that's broad-based and impacts everyone in the community, whether they're in the creative class or not. But it's true that it's this whole movement of placemaking. There's a lot of buzz around how do you make a place where young folks want to work, where the creative class wants to stay, that has some great economic ripple effects, and that's part of what we think our initiative can help with.
Okay. And I would only add to that this downtown design manual is, you know, really attempting to make downtown more attractive to not only all users, but young people in particular, who are a generation of people who increasingly don't want to use their cars, want to use bicycles for transportation. So making the streets more pedestrian friendly, making downtown an exciting place to be. So making those investments in the public infrastructure, not only to attract people, but make a more exciting downtown. I'll tell you, on the day that we were out with our red wagons and talking to those 200 people, I would say a good 80% of them were young people saying how much they loved the downtown and talking to us about the importance of making downtown a great place to be.
Okay.
Hi, I actually don't have a question. I do have a comment or something to, I hope, promote. So I'm Deb Pollack, and I'm the director of the Arts Alliance, among as well as the director of Art Train. And for those of you that are interested in this creative sector intersection with all of the other sectors, health, placemaking, economic development, environment, and so on and so forth, all of the sectors that make a vibrant community vibrant, if they are working together, we are hosting on March 19th at Eastern Michigan University, Creative Convergence 2015, where we are bringing in leaders from all over the country that are doing this kind of work so that we can understand as a community, and frankly, we're inviting people from outside throughout the state, but we can understand what we can be doing better than we're doing now for the opportunity for enhancing those creative opportunities in the future, but also bettering the community as a whole. So it's March 19th, Eastern Michigan University. It's an all-day conference. If you want to know more about it, please just write to info@a3arts.org. So thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
My name is Nancy, and I'm having this experience of sitting looking at five or six different pieces of a very large puzzle and having trouble putting them together into the whole. And maybe that's partly a result of the fact that I'm new in Ann Arbor and not familiar with a lot of the pieces, but I'm wondering if you all can help me put your pieces together into a whole.
Do I get that one?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think, and part of that is the nature of the forums. You know, the idea has been to bring short 5 to 10 minute presentations on interesting parts of our story, and I think we're never going to tell that whole story in one sitting, or we certainly can't keep you for the whole 8 hours it would take, even with cold days, and I don't think socks are going to bring a lot more people in. You know, I think when Jamie was thinking about how do we tell that economic vitality story, you know, we thought, again, there's Spark and there's a lot of economic development activity that comes on in the area, but there's a lot of other pieces to that story. And, you know, I think we don't often think of the role of philanthropy and, you know, all those donations people make and how that money lives on and how those investments in the community, you know, for example, they helped fund some of the work in PACE. And PACE is our program where we can use the city's borrowing power to loan it to local businesses to do energy efficiency investments. Well, that makes it cheaper to do business, and that's an economic development tool. We spend $250 million a year on natural gas and electricity. We should probably pay attention to that. You know, and I think the food systems, it's not the thing we normally think about, but because of investments by Ann Arbor residents and our surrounding township partners and this, there was money available so that you've got a farmer and he's sitting on $5 million worth of land, but he probably can't pay for his daughter's wedding because he can't get any of that money out. Well, here's a tool where that money changes hands. That farm stays in the community. And, you know, I think when people voted for it, they thought a lot about keeping the beautiful, you know, farmland as you leave town. But as we've learned more about the role of local food, that's a really important part of our local food story. So, I don't know, Renee, do you want to talk a little more about local food and businesses and how that fits in?
I think it's just another type of infrastructure, if you will, that enables economic vitality. So we have the design and working with the developers to see what we want to see in the city in terms of the buildings and the streets and the planning of that and then the cultural activities and then everybody eats. Everybody goes out to eat. You know, it's just, it's another part of what keeps our economy vibrant is what I was thinking. But yes, and also the public-private investment in infrastructure that's not infrastructure, that's keeping it productive farmland close to our community. That's also been a surprising driver, I think, for economic development. People didn't realize it. People thought we were stopping development, right? We were stopping all the suburbs. We were stopping sprawl. But what it's really come down to, it's been a driver in this area.
And Matt, if I could just add.
So, yeah,
so and I'm still on the learning curve as well. I'm still getting my head around what are the different pieces of the puzzle. But here's my observation. When I worked at Ford Motor Company for a while, and believe me, folks at the higher-ups at Ford at the time, it was all about Ford Motor Company. And if the darn government and others would just get out of the way, we could fly, we could be successful, we'll generate the jobs, everyone's going to be okay, right? And then I'll paint the picture of your stereotypical government person who says, all roads lead to us. We are the answer. We're the ones who are setting the stage. We're going to figure this out. We're going to fix it. And obviously, that's not the case either. And so on. And believe me, at big foundations, and we're not a big one, but at foundations often you see yourself as, boy, philanthropy is going to lead the way. We've got millions of dollars. Let's make change. And we're not tethered like the publicly elected officials are. We're going to fix everything. So the fact of the matter is everyone's wrong when they think in a silo like that. And so I guess the evolution of my understanding is, my gosh, you know, it's the opposite of all those attitudes. If I'm not speaking and working with all these people actively, public, private, nonprofit, for-profit, we may be okay, but we're not going to thrive. And I think that's the takeaway.
Thank you. Janine.
Hi, I'm Janine Palms, and I was thinking about that, sort of the link between a lot of what all of you were saying. And one of the questions is there something down the road of reinventing at least a block, if not a whole street, to be carless, to have a place where actually we can have culture there, we can have the arts there all of the time and not worry about cars going through and people can really have access. I know some cities have done that, and I was wondering if that might be something that is being thought about seriously. And then the other thing has to do with the link between food and culture. And you talked about arts a lot, and culture also is the history of food in Washtenaw County, how it was grown. All that is a real cultural history that we have, and to celebrate that in some ways, maybe even on our streets that become carless or different things like that, that we can celebrate, look at what the history is, and make the link between food, culture, and really put that. I think about it a lot because I'm part of the Cobblestone Farm Market, which is at Cobblestone Farm, which is an historic farm, and we're trying to figure out a way to link that culture of growing food with what's developing now. It's sort of, in some ways, a new culture of growing food. How do we grow food to really make it be local and to have access for people?
Great, thank you. So let's start with carless streets.
Yeah, so we've certainly talked about the idea of testing carless streets during large events and other things. So designing our streets to be flexible spaces rather than to be exclusively carless. Streets that maybe don't have curbs or that have bollards and other things that can easily close off to be a pedestrian street, but not solely a pedestrian street.
No, I think that covers it. I mean, we have a long history of evaluating pedestrian malls in downtown, and I mean in downtowns across the United States, and there are very, very few out there that survive as solely carless streets for very long. And so we have to learn from what other communities have gone through. It takes a community with a very, very large critical mass of people to fill that space of carless right away in order to make it successful, because of course businesses want people up next to their buildings and to make them thrive economically. And so we continue to look at other examples from other communities, a lot of benchmarking to see if we have the right amount of mass in our downtown. We're talking to economic consultants to guide us in that area too. But really our takeaway in the downtown design manual is we need as much flexibility as possible, and we love our special events in Ann Arbor. And so we need to spread the wealth a little bit in downtown and spread those events across other streets rather than just the ones you usually think of. So it's a really good question, Janine.
And I think we had a question about the link between food and culture. And Rena, do you want to start with that one?
Thanks for bringing it up, Janine. I think that there are a lot of connections already happening between these things, such as the, is it Nancy? Are you the new one in town? The Homegrown Festival in the fall, and then a local food summit this weekend at U of M. These two events really connect local food with other parts of it. You know, it's a cultural event. I think there's the Culinary Historians of Washtenaw County. There's Slow Food Huron Valley. So I think these things are kind of already in place. The other connection I thought of was the gentleman that asked about the creative class. Well, the new chefs, you know, the new farm to table movement, you know, those are creative people too, and I believe that they're attracted to our community because we have such a vibrant local food culture. So I hope that there's some events happening. I hope we can see more. But at all of those arts events, too, right? Food is a big part of it. Every time we close the street and have a festival, food is a big part of it. So I think it's already there.
We probably have time for one more question.
My name's Chris Good. I'm the new executive director of Think Local First. Just like to point out an observation that I saw that you all were speaking to. Everyone spoke to the importance of community engagement. and I see whether it's from the government, nonprofit, foundation, private business, it's so key to be able to speak coherently to the citizenry, to consumers, about what's the importance of these issues, whether it's sustainability, localism, supporting these local institutions. And I see I'm a farmer, musician myself, so these sectors of the community, these are passion sectors that I think really create that placemaking in an interesting and unique way. So I'm curious if any of you want to speak a little bit more about effective ways that you saw that really sparked that community engagement, because I think that's such a key piece of the puzzle.
Sure. I love talking about community engagement. It's my passion as well. We are increasingly finding new ways to engage the community with this guiding principle that, you know, anybody who's is affected by a project or a program or a policy needs to be part of the decision-making process, that nobody knows a neighborhood or a district better than the people who live there. So that's where we come at it from, that just really every project can be made better by engaging the community. So it sounds like, Chris, you believe in that too. But more and more we find that we can't just schedule a meeting and wait for people to come. We have to go out to the people as much as possible. So we're increasingly trying to broaden our methods and our ways to reach out, and you know, by going to neighborhood meetings or association meetings, kind of taking us going to them rather than expecting them to come to us, and also understanding that we need to catch people early and often when we're talking about a project, and not just wait until the project goes to City Council for some sort of an approval. And so, you know, I'd love to share ideas with you. We're always looking for new methods, and I want to hear from the younger demographic as well, because that's the hardest group to reach. We didn't have any problems reaching them that day on the street, and so looking for more ideas. So I think we should talk.
Wendy.
Yeah, I'm sorry to see that Mary Morgan has left this evening, but mm-hmm. I'm really excited about her Civ City initiative that she's trying to get up and running, and the idea is to try to really encourage engagement. And what Connie's talking about from us at the city, I mean, this is something that we do, but it's, you know, I'd like to see that groundswell of the grassroots, for lack of a better term, where you have neighborhoods that are really banding together to do something like a Snow Buddy in Water Hill or other types of initiatives like that. That's where I think a lot of this engagement will come from, is from that base, whether it's a next door group or Civ City or whatever. I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
I'll just add, at the foundation, we talk a lot, especially with cultural economic development, about a bottoms-up approach and really actively resisting the idea that someone at the top has this great idea and then you push it down. But I want to be realistic, too. It's hard. It takes resource. It takes time. And, you know, we have pressures. We want to keep our staff lean because we want to be responsible and be good stewards of this money that we're in charge of, right? We have to manage it in perpetuity. And at the same time, we know how important ongoing engagement is. So I wish I could tell you we had this magic balance we figured out at the Community Foundation. We try a lot of different ways. Every initiative we do has a different kind of engagement. But every initiative I look at, I wish there were more that we could do as well.
Okay, with that, I would like to thank our speakers. It's a tremendous amount of good stories. And thank our audience for coming out tonight, and I owe some of you some socks, so come see me.